6, 4.
Internal investigation records, entry 75. Tracking shipments of ground-to-air Patriot missiles to client countries. Now running up the numbers on TOW missiles. Israel, Kuwait, database confirmation of serial numbers, ordnance shipped and received. I guess the world sleeps safely tonight. But I don't trust numbers. Let's see if the satellite can verify cross-referencing global positioning. No signal, no position given. Jesus, those missiles never arrived.
One of my own. Give me a name.
Cerebus. That's a deep black project. Bypassing security codes. Someone removed the transmitters. Where the hell are these weapons?
Fitzgerald.
The following is intended only for mature audiences. Discretion advised.
Oh, no, that's the ending. My bad. Let's see. How should I bring us in?
Did you listen to the most recent one with Matt at the back end?
Nope.
He started doing the do-do-do-do-do-do-do, spawn.
Yeah, no, I'm not doing that. I'm trying to think how to bring us in. Welcome my spawns and spawnettes to Spawnometer. That work?
With some editing, I think.
Yeah, but, you know, fuck with it. Do some of that weird shit you do.
Why don't we have Fitzgerald shake hands with Mr. Ramir? They're such old friends.
What are we really looking at here?
A traitor, Mr. Bergen, and he's about to be dealt with. What some men will do for money is a travesty, selling missiles to a known terrorist. The voice?
The voice is even easier than the visual, Mr. Wynn.
Psychological profile?
Paranoid, delusional. It reads like a Greek tragedy. Shame how quickly a man can crash and burn.
Splendid observation, Bergen. I suggest you keep it in mind should you ever be tempted to shop your skills.
I am aware of your reputation, sir.
Of course you are. Your fee has already been wired.
So what are we reading today?
So today we are being tortured with issue 22 of the Almighty Spawn.
What do you think of the cover?
It's real basic. I feel like Todd did this one in 10 minutes. You just throw a skull and spawn around it. Mm-hmm. By this time, I feel the covers are getting a little lazy.
My intention was to do like a top 30 Spawn covers for the 300th issue anniversary a few months back. And the Spawn covers are just so samey. I was really struggling. And that's part of the reason why it still isn't out is I was just really struggling differentiating them enough to actually do a ranking.
Some of those early ones were pretty good.
As you said, we were talking for like an hour before we started work on the episode, and so I've been staring at this cover for most of that time, and I do appreciate all the little twisty things that he's doing with the cape, but it also looks like something you'd probably knock out pretty quick, like you said.
Oh, yeah, dude. This was definitely done at a con. This was a commissioned con piece, probably. Look at the skull. Dude. I mean, there's no background.
Mm. Well, come on, little, Todd. Like, quickie star things. I think the colors dropped in there.
Step up your time. Oh, wait a minute. He dedicated this to Frank Miller?
I suspect that was because of Batman Spawn.
Oh, yes, right. That's right.
Yeah. It was actually out a little bit after this issue, I think. Let's see. This one came out June 27th, 1994. This is Spawn number 22. Just for comparison, the fifth issue of Pit came out the same month, Supreme number 13, and Youngblood number 6. That was the return of Rob Liefeld after his brief sabbatical from comics in his first Youngblood issue, if I recall correctly. So what
and who was number one on the top 40?
I didn't go that deep into it. We need Mac for that kind of shit.
Probably like Veruca Salt.
94?
Nah, I'm just fucking what you did. Not even close.
Volcano so, girls we start really this issue.
I swear. So we start this issue in a office environment with a man ferociously writing. I believe his name is Joe. How do you say his last name?
Sakic or Sakic?
Yeah. I'm just going to call him Joey Sacks.
And he's furiously accounting.
Oh, that's right. He's the accountant, right? That's right. That makes more sense. Scribing like crazy. The accountant for Tony Twist?
Yeah. I can never keep this straight because sometimes he's Don Dracula. I always think Tony Twist, even though the lawsuit says otherwise.
Yeah.
When I'm reading the issue, the most current version is Vito Gravano. Nobody's going to fucking remember that shit. So it's Tony fucking Twist.
Okay. I was going to say, I like Tony Twist. That just works better for me.
It's a much better mafia name than it is a hockey player name.
Tony the Twist. Spawn freaks out Joey Sacks here. Joey Sacks has a lot of info of the criminal organization because Spawn's there to get some information. But now, was this a lead up to find information on Terry, or was he just trying to find information on Tony Twist?
I don't remember issue 21 well enough to tell you.
Oh, okay, my bad.
I think that shit's been going on in Spawn alleys. The mafia is always fucking around with shit there. So I have to assume that that was what it was about. Going after the accountant is straight out of the Untouchables.
The Untouchables. I'm about to say, what is Sean Connery? If they bring a knife, you bring a gun.
If they put one of yours in the hospital, you put one of theirs in the morgue. That's how you get Capone.
Hey, it's a good movie, man.
I love Untouchable.
Really? I thought you were like, you know what I hate? You know what really grinds my gears? I was waiting for a frank moment like that.
I always remember to talk about the Monster Squad being seen on that day when my father was doing the concessions at the movie theaters, and I caught pieces of movies all that day as I rode along with him. And I always forgot the same thing was Untouchables. I saw the vast majority of Untouchables, but after Sean Connery's character dies, spoiler for a 30-year-old movie, it took me like a year or so afterwards, and I finally caught the ending on video, and I was kind of disappointed, not because it was bad, but just because it took me so long to see it that I couldn't get as excited for it. And plus, it's just not as good of a movie once Sean Connery's gone. Then it becomes Kevin Costner's movie, and Kevin Costner ain't no Sean Connery.
True. But, see, in our family, since my dad would have to tolerate Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Ernest Goes to Camp, anything along Transformers the movie 86, since my dad had to endure that, we would have to go see one of his films, which was always like Colors, Untouchables. So yeah, I was a young lad sitting in a theater watching mobster movies.
That explains a lot, actually.
Yeah, my dad, I remember going to see Goodfellas. We were the only kids in the theater. Now that I think of it, I'm like, oh, dude, I bet you there's people like, God damn it, this dude brought his kids. They're not going to shut the fuck up, are they? I'm sure people were feeling that at the time.
Yeah, I guess it wasn't Take Your Kids to the Martin Scorsese Day.
Hey, we got dragged to go see Apocalypse Now in the theaters.
Oh, damn.
Actually, the one very vivid moment or memory I have is my father taking us to go see Lawrence of Arabia, which is a beautiful movie. And I remember at one point looking at my father and saying, I have to go pee. And he looked me dead in the eye and said, hold it. It builds character. That was a nugget of knowledge passed down from Pop. So I was like, okay. And then, as soon as intermission hit, dude ran to the John as fast as I could. That movie has a special place in my heart.
Yeah. I will say too, Untouchables has one of the best theme scores of any movie.
Oh yeah.
I love it. And it's one of those ones where if I'm walking down the street and I want to feel cool, that'll just start playing in my brain.
When I hear that theme song, I always imagine the part where Kevin Costner's throwing, what's his name? The monster off the top of the building.
Billy Drago.
Yeah. When he fucking throws him off and they're like, where's so-and-so? He's in the car. It's like, oh, such a great line. All right. Anyway, so back to the accountant. Spawn is threatening Joey Sacks. This one got a little bloody because Joey Sacks has a couple of gunmen that interrupt the conversation. And Spawn actually, as they fire, he's no longer amazed that his costume is protecting him, that it automatically goes into defense mode and starts ricocheting bullets away from him. It's almost a gimme now. It grabs a table, slams it against their heads, and you have two blood splots against the wall, which was pretty gruesome.
Yeah, it's like two red eyes or something.
Yeah, I take it this was not a comic book code approved.
No, well, I remember it was a big thing that they used to have Spawn at places like Walmart, and I think it was specifically the Grant Morrison, Greg Capullo issues where Spawn like shoots the general in the eyeball. They put a halt to that. If it wasn't that one, then it was the one with the cover of Spawn getting lynched.
Oh, wow. I just remember the one where Alan Moore, where the woman is, you could almost see her full boob when they're in the different levels of hell.
Okay, yeah.
I remember that one, people having a lot of issues with at my local shop that I would go to. People were like, oh, you can almost see her boobs. I'm like, really? Can I get two issues?
One for each.
Joey Sacks goes in to reach into a safe while Spawn is admiring his cape's work, and he pulls out a folder that apparently has stuff on Terry.
Well, it's supposed to be, this file's on Terry. I'll be borrowing this one for a while, Joe. Thanks.
Apparently, he was keeping tabs on Terry? I was a little confused. And again, I don't remember 21 either, so. Next, we go to Twitch and Bullock.
Bullock?
He looks like Bullock from Batman.
He really is. It's true. I've always thought so.
Every time I see him, I immediately think of Bullock. So Bullock is eating a donut. And I gotta admit, with this art, he was getting a little experimental with like the fly's eyes, and you see the fly on the donut, and Bullock's about to eat the donut. This one was a lot wordy too. Lots of words for a Spawn comic.
Sam and Twitch just follow up on a lead, so there isn't much.
Oh, that's right. His name is Sam. Like,
yeah, no worries. There isn't much going on there, but they still talk a lot. But then you get to the Jason Wynn page, where it's another one of these sequences where it's Jason Wynn in a dark room with a window that's like multiple stories tall. Then everything else is just blackness and words and words and words. It's a fucking novel over here.
No. That literally is a Spawn issue worth of dialogue, I told
you. That's like the script, for a Spawn issue, just on this one page.
And it is extremely descriptive about what is going on in Jason's life at that time. His failures, his loss of power, his investigation of Terry, how, you know, he's too clean. He's concerned with the way he's being seen by other people in power. It's almost like a weakness, I guess you would say. Am I correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, after his disappearance and all the scrutiny that's come with that, when he became the anti-Spawn, his position of authority is in question. He'd already launched the investigation into Terry Fitzgerald in relation to the weapons that went missing. And even though his information is coming back that the guy's clean, he's decided, well, it doesn't matter. Right? This guy's still going to take the fall for me, if for no other reason than because he can't be seen as weak or having errors in judgment.
Yeah. At that point, we see Terry, who's on his computer at work, and receives a special gift of a rat with a knife through it. I guess they're saying he's a rat?
Yeah. People in his departments have been told that he's corrupt. There's a gossip campaign that's been initiated by Wynn, and it's just kind of closing in on him. And if I remember correctly, this was pretty influential for the Spawn TV show too, right? The cartoon?
Yes.
Like the better part of a season was the same scenario of Terry getting framed and having all these walls closing in on everything.
I'd have to rewatch the series, but I feel like that was definitely a story arc in the show.
Because I always think of Wynn being a bigger presence in Spawn's life in the comics, but really it was the TV show where he was such a defining character.
Now, I gotta admit, this next panel was one of my favorites, where Spawn is sitting on his throne of trash, and they had that really great line. They state that the people of the alley need him to play the part, to be their savior, their newfound god. Found that quite interesting.
It is another instance, too, where most of the page is black and there's all this white text.
Was Todd getting experimental here?
I think that this is Todd on the last story arc that he was going to draw, pulling out stops. Yeah. Now, I do think that he's using these minimal pages to make up for how much visual information he's packing into scenes like Sam and Twitch when Sam's eating the donut.
A donut,
and,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of detailing going on there. So I do think that he's putting the effort on those pages and he's pulling back some of his time with some of these less involved pages.
So would you say that's a lot of exposition?
It's purple prose. I think it's giving flavor to the story.
Okay.
So I'm willing to forgive it. Like you say, it gives you a sense of who Spawn is to the people he's around, what his role is, and how he's perceived or anything else. It's a sort of a novelistic approach, so I'll forgive him for
I guess you're saying he basically is just trying to flush out the characters more.
And the world itself, yeah.
I can agree with that. We now see Tony Twist walking with a professor, and they're discussing our favorite overt kill and how they're rebuilding him. And this is what, the third time they've built him?
At least, yeah.
Yeah, I'm starting to lose count.
I'm trying to figure, this isn't the same scientist that's got the brother that works with Youngblood, right?
I think so, dude. It looks like him.
Okay. I mean, it makes sense. They're on the same time frame.
Yeah. Overt Gill got this cool thing where he's strapped down with belts and wires and tubes. I thought he was just a head and the body was its own machine. You just have to connect his head to it. Because we already have him floating around just as a head.
You know, I caught a little bit of Teen Titans Go to the Movies the other night. Cyborg can do the same thing where he shoots his head off and everything. I do think that maybe a lot of the Cyborg from Teen Titans Go came from Overt Kill, so he does have some kind of a legacy.
Well, so Tony wants Overt Kill ready because it seems like he's going to get rid of two rats at one time.
Make a big point of stating that Tony Twist is in a similar position as Jason Wynn, where he's being perceived as weak because he's lost all this money and he's lost all these resources to this vigilante in this alleyway. You know, all the shit where he had to rebuild Overt Kill from scratch and everything else. So he needs a show of force to reinstate himself and his role in his own sphere, just like with Wynn.
So I guess the running theme of this is men in power are feeling threatened because
everybody's being threatened. I mean, Terry's being challenged eventually through Terry and Terry's family. Spawn's getting challenged.
Everybody's being threatened as well.
Yeah,
that's his Achilles heel. Terry's in the house. He's nervous. His wife and daughter have gone out of town to visit family.
They're going to visit Grandma Blake.
Grandma, that's right. He has two G-men in the driveway protection detail.
Before you go too far, though, you forgot to mention what Spawn realizes when he's reading the folder that he got from the accountant, that Vito thinks I'm Terry.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So that's why Overkill is being sent not after necessarily Spawn specifically, but after Terry Fitzgerald.
That's right, because he thought that he was Terry. And at this point,
In the sequence with Tony Twist, he also makes a point of mentioning that the other matter he needs to deal with is they're going to whack that clown. This story, The Hunt, is taking place parallel to the Violator miniseries. And so that's a whole other power play that's going on, off to the side that we're going to deal with fairly soon.
Gotcha. These mobsters jump out and machine gun the two G-men in their vehicle. Or there's a gun battle. Terry gets out there. He's helping in the gun battle.
I don't know why it's CIA agents operating in the United States, but the CIA has staked out Terry's house. And then the mobsters show up to go after Terry.
But I thought they were his protection.
No, they're not his protection. They're fucking watching his ass. He's a rat, remember?
I misread that.
Yeah. So what ends up happening is that when the CIA sees the gunman from the mafia, they try to stop him, but they're outgunned. And then Terry shows up with his own gun and it becomes this big crossfire. The mobsters kill the CIA agents.
Well, we realize that once Terry is in the yard, he gets up there. Both CIA agents are dead.
Well, and Terry's smart enough to actually take cover, and he's got an actual assault rifle where the two CIA agents just had fucking Berettas or some shit. So they were totally blown away by assault rifles. And then the mobsters are like, oh, and we've kidnapped your wife and daughter.
Wife and kid,
Come to the alley at midnight or we're going to whack them. Not realizing that they're okay, but this is pre-cell phones, so they're inaccessible while they're out with Grandma Blake.
And now we have all this dialogue again. Just blah, dialogue. Blah. Of what's going through Terry's mind. Sounds of sirens drawing closer and the neighborhood starts to peek through their curtains. Terry does the only thing he can think of. He runs.
Well, okay. It's a black man with an assault rifle and two dead CIA agents. I mean, I'm no bullshit. What the fuck else are you going to do?
True. Well, I mean, yeah, you've just gotten threatened. You think your family's been kidnapped. I'm sure a million things are running through his head. I mean, they wrote it all down. And next we see Spawn in his alley on his throne of trash where he's being spoken to by one of the homeless men that live there. They're letting him know that he's coming, just like you said, over on 6th. And Spawn has just finished reading the file on Terry. He knows that Tony Twist is mentioned about sending Overt Kill to kill him, telling him he better hurry up. He thinks it's Terry that's over there, but it turns out, no, it's that robot as big as a bus. We don't stand a chance. So Spawn decides he's going to go take care of it. Thanks him for the warning. We get there, and there's Overt Kill, and Terry's hiding behind a dumpster.
I think Terry thought he was just going to be dealing with some mobsters, so when this gigantic cyborg killing machine comes for him, he's just like, Wanda, Cyan, I love you.
I felt like there was a panel missing. We immediately just get there, and there's Overt Kill, and Terry's hiding behind a dumpster.
Well, I mean, I think that's the thing is that the homeless community was watching out for Terry and for Overkill, and the two of them were meeting, and dude's like, hey, Al, you gotta go deal with this now.
Yeah, sure.
This guy he doesn't look out for. And Al goes looking for his cache of weapons that he stole that started this whole thing, and they're gone. They're missing. He doesn't know where they're at.
Can't find where'd I put them? And that's when Twitch puts his, 357?
It's a Magnum, I'm thinking, Magnum revolver. Puts it right to Al's head, because they've also been staking out the alley.
And at this point, Spawn's at 7.8.6.4.
Yes, the return of the Spawn finally.
Yep.
I think when was that, man?
It's been a while.
We didn't have it in the writer's series, and I think we might have gotten one or two in the meantime. Nothing through the Grant Morrison stuff, nothing through the fill-in issues, and finally, second chapter of The Hunt in the 20s, we've got the Spawnometer back.
So I was going to make sure to bring that up once I saw it. I'm like, it's back! The whole point of our damn show is
back! Our namesake is returned!
I feel complete now.
So, speaking of feeling complete, how do you feel about the issue?
It was pretty good. It's a lot of wordsy, and they're giving us an idea where we're going with it. I mean, you said this was the end of Todd's run, right?
As an artist?
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, generally speaking, he didn't draw anything for a while after this, at least not doing the pencils.
We're going to see where it's going to go. Not sure yet.
I was complaining a lot about the glacial pacing on the first part of The Hunt. I was just tired of them constantly reiterating shit. And there's a bit of that in this issue too, but I do think it's more about setting the mood and getting pieces in place, and we are starting to see some things kind of come together. Things start to come to a head. My hope and expectation is there'll be some sort of resolution to the wind situation by the end of the story arc, that the whole story arc of Terry being framed and having to deal with problems with his own agency, I think that's coming to a head. I just feel like The Hunt's going to go somewhere, and I'll be really fucking pissed off if I'm wrong, but I did actually enjoy this issue, and I definitely see more effort on Todd's part, both in trying to write more material and try to be more writerly in his approach, but also more of a cinematic quality to how he's staging the action and the panel progressions and everything else. I just see I can see the effort that Todd's putting into it, and I do appreciate it because I am getting more enjoyment out of the story with this chapter versus the first one.
I think it's okay. Apparently, you really took on to that. Blah, more dialogue. Blah, more dialogue. So, yeah, I thought it was okay. Well, see where it's going. It's part one of the hunt. So
I also didn't have to read the full issue in a few minutes' time before part we started two. Recording.
Yeah, true.
I'd actually regret it before we started the Skype call.
Well, I'll try to read the material ahead of time from now on. I'd be so tardy in my work.
Who the fuck are you? Get your hands off me.
Selling arms to a terrorist. That was an improper thing to do, Mr. Fitzgerald.
This is bullshit.
Of course it is. Anything more to say?
You can't just...
You just resisted arrest.
Wizard Holofoil Series, number 5. Rob Liefeld Supreme. Real name unknown. Age unknown. Height 6'6". Weight 1,800 pounds. First appearance, Youngblood number 3, October 1992, created by Rob Liefeld. During the early 1900s, Supreme was one of only a handful of super beings on the planet, and easily the most powerful. Though revered as a god, he grew weary of life on Earth and set off to find new roles to call his home. Dissatisfied with what he found, he returned to Earth in 1993. Since his departure almost a century earlier, the world had changed. With such super beings as Youngblood, Spawn, and Brigade in existence, Supreme was no longer number one. Now one of the most powerful beings in existence must deal with something even his awesome might may not be able to handle, a bruised ego. Kiboshimeter, 9.5 out of 10.
Hey, what's up? This is Derek WC of Fanholes Podcast and History of Comics on Film.
So tell me your Image Comics journey. Did you read the books when they were first coming out?
Yes. I was all in the middle of the shiznit. I was all rolled up in the hype. I think I followed a lot of the Image creators when they were on Marvel titles. So I read things like The Amazing Spider-Man, The Adjectiveless Spider-Man for Larson and McFarlane. I read The New Mutants that turned into X-Force, on and off. Just because you had to, because you weren't cool unless you were reading X-Men. So often I bummed copies of X-Men off other kids or whatever. I was more of a X-Factor kid myself, but you weren't cool unless you were reading the X-Men. Not only was I familiar with Silvestri and Jim Lee, but I mean, I also ended up reading a lot of those books when they were coming out. Will Sportaccio doing the Bishop Uncanny X-Men stuff. All that stuff I followed. And then, of course, Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm one of the, five people that knew what that was before it was a movie. Followed the Jim Valentino 90s book, and I really liked that. When Image was announced, the short version of it is, I followed almost all the Image titles right before Gen 13 came out, and like a moron, I didn't buy any copies of Gen 13, and of course, that was the one book that was hot as fuck, and had these $20, $30 price tags or whatever, and it made me mad, because I think I went back and bought a trade of those first issues so I could read the story, but it was one of those things where I went out and bought all the stupid Kenner Batman Returns figures, and then got burnt out. Just like I got burnt out on Image. And then the minute I got burnt out on those figures, then Batman the Animated Series came out and all those animated figures came out. And I was like, I'm not buying this. And of course, those were all the figures that were worth mad cash on the aftermarket afterwards. So I'm like, damn you, burnout. I pretty much read Youngblood, Spawn, Brigade, Supreme, Prophet, Cyberforce, Wildcats, all that kind of stuff when it was pretty much brand new. I think I got burnt out on some titles sooner than others. And I think also with the big comic boom, there was that portion of my reading history where I followed books faithfully off the stands to a point, and then when I got burnt out or gave up on those books, I think later I filled in the blanks with a lot of things, because once the speculator bubble crashed, I think there were all these stores in my local area that were going out of business, and then that gave me an opportunity to go back and get books for like 25 cents or something. I think I didn't feel as guilty. I didn't mind paying 25 cents for a $2.50, $3 book or whatever it was that they were doing for Image.
And that's actually how I started reading Supreme, was that the comic shop I was running had plenty of Image comics in the quarter bins. Of course, we were trying to blow them out too. And I came into comics retailing during the bust. I've never was there for the good times. I was there always there for the bust. So like you, I'm also an anti-influencer, getting on the stuff that does not go over. And Supreme just won me over because I enjoyed that take on a Superman type character. So that was also my course. And to this day, you know, one of the reasons why Spawnometer exists is is I can go and pick up Image Comics back issues for on the cheap for 50 cents, for a dollar. You can't necessarily do that with almost anything else, but the Image stuff was just so pervasive. A lot of it's so undesirable that you can get a pretty good deal on it.
Yeah, I guess if you want to specifically look at my Supreme trajectory, I think I stuck with that book for a pretty long time. I'd say up until or maybe past the 20s, depending on who was writing it or who had to facilitate certain story points. Since he originates from Superman, sometimes they went back to default niceties of a Superman trope, whereas you'd think if they were really exploring somebody who viewed everyone but himself as a genetic abomination, that there would be certain story curves that would have taken place. Sometimes they went with that, and sometimes I think just for the ease of having a easily wrapped up crossover where everybody shakes hands and winks and says goodbye, sometimes they didn't do that, I think.
Nothing had a pretty bow on it when it came to Supreme, just like you said.
I feel like the first 6 or 7 issues, the stuff where Brian Murray was exclusively doing the pencils, doing this, I want to call it like, what if Rob Liefeld tried to ape the style of Neil Adams or something? Like, I don't know if that's a good mesh or comparison or whatever, but I feel like that's the vibe I would get when I read those early issues of Supreme. It's got all that early installment weirdness, I guess is the trope they call it, but for some reason, that seemed to have a lot of promise and potential, and I was curious where it was all going to go. And I think it just came off the rails after that. I think now I'm old enough that I recognize all the tropes beyond just Superman. Early on, I was just fascinated because I liked Superman. Sometimes I would follow whatever the Superman pastiche was at the time, and Supreme was no exception. Even though Chrome talks and has dialogue and things like that, I always kind of view Chrome as his doomsday or something like that. But I guess in reality, he'd probably be more like a Mongol or something like that.
I think
but
that's
still,
exactly right. That was my read too, that he was sort of a Mongol.
I remember just enjoying everything that led up to that. They're not quite as elegant as Alan Moore's parallels. It's like Zachariah Gridlock or Grislock or whatever is not quite Darius Dax. And they're both Lex Luthor, but they're both kind of not Lex Luthor. For me, I was fascinated reading those. I think that's why I point to those first 7 issues, because I feel like that's the purest of the Superman concept.
After its launch on December 4th, 1992, Supreme had some production delays. The second issue didn't arrive until March 16th, the third on June 29th, the fourth on July 20th, the fifth on September 7th, and the sixth on October 18th. However, by number 7, released November 15th, 1993, the book was on a fairly consistent schedule, one of the very few Image Comics that could claim that. 8 issues in just over a year for an Image Comic was pretty damn good. The cover to number 7 was provided by Art T-Bear, who was moving over from the X titles to Image Comics at the time, particularly working with Extreme Studios to promote his upcoming book, Black and White. He did another pinup that appeared in an issue of Supreme that was really excellent. As a Superman type, guest artists probably had an easier time figuring out who Supreme was for pinups, so more of his personality shows up in his pictures, and he tends to, seemingly to me at least, draw a higher caliber of artists for those pinups. Jason Pearson provides one for issue number 6, Mike Wieringo for issue number 8, Kevin McGuire on number 9, and Han Nguyen on issue 10. Issue number 7 picked up with the cliffhanger involving the Star Guard, a super team from the future that claimed to be the children of Supreme. It's a big Legion of Superheroes riff.
So the Star Guard show up in those first couple issues and they warn Supreme of something. It's the Mon-El clone.
A Superman type called Vaylin, the one that most resembled Supreme but had black hair.
The, I guess, essentially Supergirl clone, whose name is Probe.
A white-haired young woman in a revealing outfit, red with some gold highlights.
And then the rest of them are, I want to say, like Brainiac Fives, because it's like there's a female diehard, there's a cougar.
The Youngblood member, looking more like he did in his promotional image from Marvel Age when the character was intended to be a member of the New Mutants.
Who I'm assuming is not the cougar, but a future cougar or something.
Oh, and it's funny too, because to me, cougar always looked really similar to Timberwolf from the Legion, so it's almost like a nod to that.
I guess you could definitely make that analogy, the Timberwolf analogy. There's the Speedster character, whose name is Godspeed.
A mysterious African-American new god-looking character.
They have all those characters. They warn Supreme of some impending doom, and then they show up to warn him a few more times or something, like before Thor or something like that. But you're like, whatever happens to them?
The Rumblings of Thunder featured a story by Ripley and Eric Stevenson, pencils and inks by Sean McManus, script, lettering, and editing by Kurt Hathaway, and colors continued to be by Brian Murray. After his brief encounter with the Star Guard, Supreme is ambushed by reporter Maxine Winslow. Alexander Graves of Youngblood orders Heavy Metal to be disbanded, and after this story arc, Jason Temple never appears again. Part of Graves' rationale is how badly Gate has been handling issues of late, including references to the Infinity story, the debut of Prophet, and the Blood Brothers arc in Bloodstrike, Strike, and Brigade. If you read the Supreme Letters column, you'll note that the Heavy Metal team were not particularly popular. A lot of people stating that with characters as powerful as Supreme, you don't need a bunch of other guys with him. He doesn't really make sense in a team book, and disparaging the individual members of the team.
One thing that I thought was frustrating, too, is Supreme lacked for people that should have realistically been able to challenge him. One thing that bugged me is, like, you set up Heavy Metal in the first issues, and then you have Alexander Graves from Youngblood show up, and as best I can tell, Jason Temple is a Max Lord type who runs Gate Industries, and Graves is like, Heavy Metal's no more, and we're cutting ties with Supreme, and they just leave it like that, and those guys never appear again, and yet these are guys that were supposed to have been able to go toe-to-toe with Supreme for a while, especially Skyhook or Skyhook, whatever that.
Oh, yeah. Because he had the blade that could cut his skin and all that stuff. And he presumably, he's one of those many alien races that Supreme encountered in his exile or something, right? That could have been something worth exploring as well.
And instead, we get four issues of Supreme fighting Thor.
Yeah.
In the Extreme Comics universe, Thor is an old enemy of Supreme's going back to World War II. He had worked on the side of Germany, but now was seeking Hitler, who had betrayed him and trapped him in the mountains since the 1940s. Supreme is uncommunicative at the most basic level, not even telling Thor Hitler is dead, which would have likely ended the fight that ran for multiple issues. The story continues into issue 8, The Final Fury, this time with a sole story credit by Ripley, but otherwise the same creative team. Number 9 carries over the same writing team, but the art is now by Brian Murray and Chris Ivey. We also find out that sometime around 1979, criminal genius Zachariah Grislock began a 14-year stay in prison, eventually working with government entities out of boredom while awaiting the hopeful return of Supreme. With Supreme back, he breaks loose and returns to his secret lab under Fort Knox. Supreme and Thor have a punch out until Thor gets dumped at Gate Industries. The late, not Lois Lane, Louise Masters, has her grave visited. Supreme then visits the middle-aged former Kid Supreme named Charles. And finally, envious of Youngblood's fame and acceptance, Supreme agrees to a live Maxine Winslow TV interview. Supreme number 10, The Interview, features a story by Rob Liefeld, script lettering, editing by Kurt Hathaway, the final issue with pencils and colors by Brian Murray, plus inks by Joe Rubenstein.
It's weird, because I know you wanted to talk about the origin issue, too, because in that initial image run of Supreme, I would say it somehow amalgamates Our Man and Captain America's origin, and then it turns him into Superman. I don't know if it's uncomfortable, but there's that element of, I just kept taking pills and taking drugs, or maybe you could even attribute it to something like Tetsuo and Akira shoving fistfuls of pills down his mouth to keep the pain down. I think the insinuation, at least in that comic, is that after a series of unknown combinations of bombardments of radioactive whatever, and a bunch of random pills, he became Supreme. Oh, well, great. He's not from another planet, but somehow they just bombarded him with enough rays of whatever and gave him enough pills of whatever so that now he's essentially Superman.
It's definitely a kooky as fuck origin. And of course, you got the ties with Prophet because it's still Dr. Wells, and you've got all the weird eugenic stuff in there. And it's like, okay, so wait, did they just kept throwing shit at the wall against all these different subjects? And he was the only one that it took, but like I said, write down the particular mixture. I mean, what the fuck is even going on with Supreme?
That's why it reminded me of Captain America. The formula that made Captain America's shield can never be reproduced. And it's like the formula that created Supreme could never accurately be reproduced because of reasons. So nobody was keeping track of that shit, I guess. But I think the Legend of Supreme gives it a little more nefariousness, and he wasn't just some guy giving up a high-paying job or whatever to serve his country.
The Legend of Supreme is an upcoming mini series that sheds more light on Supreme's origins. But as we understand it initially, he was a volunteer to a government program in 1939. He is exposed to all these different catalysts, and eventually he becomes so powerful that he refuses to continue to be studied by the scientists because he's just too much of a Supreme being to be bothered with that trifle. In 1939, Supreme is publicly identified as the first of his superpower generation to appear in this century, being the 20th. He would go on to make essential contributions to the Allied war effort against the Axis powers. Given the obeisance of modern media, the news, to political figures and the like, it's weird to me how many openly antagonistic journalists there are in Rob Liefeld comics, not the least of which is Maxine Winslow of WABC, who is constantly trying to ambush Supreme and have all these very aggressive interviews blaming him for the death of her father at the airport when the terrorist struck and all this kind of bullshit.
I feel like if you're going to make a Superman pastiche that is egocentric and arrogant, that's the twist, then this twist is he had a Lois Lane Marine that apparently was really nice to him and gave him a lot of good press back in pre-World War II. And then she's the one who gets killed by Zachariah Grislog. But then you've got Maxine, right? And it's almost like, what if, you know, this might be an oxymoron, but it's like, what if Lois Lane was a bitch? Or what if Lois Lane was a reporter out for herself? Or what if Lois Lane blamed Superman for the death of General Lane or something like that? That's the kind of twist on Lois Lane that they're doing there, I feel like. I mean, that was my take on it. It's interesting you point out the media thing, because, I mean, I could see that maybe now more so than ever with how much access we have to creators and people on social media, you know? Like, I could see that. These clickbaity assassination articles on guys like Rob Liefeld. So you could see maybe why there'd be that distrust of a figure from the media. But even when she sits down to interview him, I don't know, how are you supposed to take that interview? He's upset because people don't remember him, because I think what triggers him to agree to do the interview, even though he's been blowing her off the whole time, is that people seem to pay attention more to the Youngbloods because they're constantly on the 24-hour news media cycle, right? And he's like, oh, well, I need to get in on that action, so I'll agree to do this interview. And then he shows up and gives the semi-standard, with certain aspects hidden of his backstory, origin interview. And then he basically says he's a god. And then it's like one of those things where that's kind of a good idea, but you wish if it wasn't an Image comic or a Liefeld comic and somebody was actually exploring the ramifications of a Superman-like figure saying he was a god, you'd want to cut to like the Giffen guys. Didn't they have that like church of whatever it was with all the cyber guys and stuff?
Or Covenant of the Sword.
Yeah, I'm not saying you have to make it a real organization. Like, I'm not saying you have to have, like, the Roman Catholic Church go, we got to send Overkill after Supreme or some shit. But something like that, those guys, maybe they could say, well, that's blasphemous or whatever. We're going to send a bunch of people after them or some such, you know, or whatever. It almost seems like people automatically laughed that off or didn't take it seriously and just wrote him off as being arrogant. I would have liked to see the people that, in that 24-hour news cycle, took that at its word and then also actively made lengths to try to end him either with some kind of physical attack or maybe just trying to turn public opinion against Supreme because of something like that. Some little kid that might have been like, yay, Supreme, you're my hero. But then it's like, if they're devoutly religious, then going, hey, look at what Supreme said. Isn't that kind of strange? It's like, sorry, Supreme, I can't play with your toy anymore because Pastor so-and-so said that there's only one true God and you're not the God. But they never had an issue like that. And I thought that might have been interesting.
Well, I mean, look at how it blew up for John Lennon. And he wasn't even saying that he was a God. He was bemoaning that people were having the sort of fervor for the Beatles that they should have had for religion or would have normally had religion.
Right.
So when you've got this guy who actually is like, no, I'm basically God, you would expect a stronger reaction, some pushback.
It's weird because it seemed like in later issues they toned it down too, because I think in that he basically was like, I'm God. But then I think later when he's talking to Thor and fighting with Thor and he's amongst other gods, he'd be like, well, basically I'm unto a God.
Smarmy reporter Jack Leeds, who we know has an axe to grind with Team Youngblood, breaks in with a WABC news report on the release of a powerful superhuman named Quantum, who was in battle with unidentified Youngbloods in Arizona. Afterwards, Supreme ditches the interview midway through. The official tie-in to Extreme Prejudice, number 11, features art by Petey, or Petty.
But I think once they started doing Supreme Madness, and then every other issue, Supreme got rolled into Extreme Destroyer, Extreme Sacrifice. I'm trying to think, like, Supreme Apocalypse. You know, there were all these crossovers. There were all these things he had to endure. So it's like, you'll be reading a narrative with Supreme, and then all of a sudden, it'll get literally interrupted. Because that first crossover, was it Extreme Destroyer or Extreme Sac? I don't know. Anyway, it was the one with Quantum, the Magneto knockoff guy,
right? Extreme Prejudice.
Extreme Prejudice. See, like, I can't remember any of this stuff. But anyway.
They're all extreme something or other. It's easy for them all to run together.
Yeah. Basically, Magneto kicks the crap out of Superman and gives him, like, this, I don't know, green fart that takes away his powers. And then after that, it's like they treat him just like a Superman pastiche, but he's got Thor's hammer. Thor's hammer is supposed to somehow make up the difference, because it gets confusing, because you think, aren't you normal now? Don't you not have powers? But yet he would run around and do this whole world tour where he got into fights with the strongest guys in the Image universe, and he was essentially powerless. But he wasn't powerless because he had the hammer, and they just treated him like he had his powers almost. almost.
Because Quantum is able to fuck with Supreme's powers in Extreme Prejudice, do you think that there's any way of explaining Supreme's powers having something to do with the electromagnetic spectrum? But he goes through space, so right, it doesn't make any sense, right? There's no way of explaining this shit.
No, I don't. I mean, it's a good idea, but then unless there's some kind of kooky, like Loki made a universal electromagnetic spectrum or something, like, I don't know, they don't say anything like that. So
Supreme number 12 features a Liefeld story. McManus, No Con, and Ratman on art. Fourth-filled Kurt Pathaway writes, letters, and edit. The depowered Supreme lands in a South American jungle. He uses Mjolnir, two L's, to fly back to Washington, D.C. He shakes down the minor villain, Simple Simon Simpkins, in a bar for info on Grizzlock's whereabouts. We're given the origin of the Zachariah Grizzlock feud, basically that he had been working on inventions that could have led to the hydrogen bomb. Mobsters came into his business and tried to either kidnap him or steal the plans, I'm not sure which. Supreme was flying by, interceded. The Hoods ended up blowing up the company. Supreme saved everybody who was in the building. But then when the nature of the secrets that Grizzlock had came to light, they were taken as evidence by the feds. Zachariah Grizzlock's business was basically ruined. His plans were stolen by the government, and he's hated Supreme ever since. And to that end, he thinks he's concocted a solution that will take away Supreme's powers and allow him to be killed by a mech suit he's created called the Supreme Slayer. Issue number 13 is by the same creative team. Supreme is struggling with his hammer, but because he doesn't have his Supreme powers, the concoction of Zachariah Grizzlock doesn't have any impact on him. He can't lose powers that he's already lost. Supreme tries to use Mjolnir on the Supreme Slayer, but the armor is impervious to its impacts. However, a lightning is able to destroy the cooling unit on the device. Grizzlock gets smoked out of it. The suit itself is ultimately destroyed. Grizzlock is about to be executed, but he uses his knowledge of physiology to bait Supreme with the promise of saving his powers. Of course, he instead sets a trap, intending to kill Supreme. Doesn't really work out that way. The impression that I was under was that when Grizzlock had tried to assassinate him by supposedly using Thor's hammer as a conduit to restore his powers, and then as you said, he goes nuts, and there's an explosion in the lab. It kills Grizzlock, which is extremely anticlimactic, because they have this whole buildup where he's a serial killer Lex Luthor who's waited 50 years to get his revenge on Supreme, and then he dies in an explosion and he's never seen again. And you're like, what the fuck? You're just waiting for that to get reversed. Supreme Madness Part 2 is by Rob Liefeld with art by Dan Fraga. Writer, letter, editor is still Kurt Hathaway. Simple Simon tortures and kills Horace's brother Ronald for Grizzlock's location. Horace is the underling that's been working with Grizzlock since he broke out of prison.
Union was more of a Wildstorm character, if I remember correctly. I remember Tech'Shira did the Union Image miniseries, and I think they were, like most of the people that ended up in Supreme's world tour in Supreme Madness, he was also, in his own way, Superman level pastiche. I guess Supreme Madness tried to pair him up against other Image characters that were quote unquote heroes that would have been a reasonable match for him. I buy that Union would be that. Even in Deathmate, they tried to pull him in as the ace card or the unaccounted factor that nobody had thought of. You know, they kind of just recently created him, and then they were like, hey, check out Union. It seemed like he was a nicer character than Supreme was. I don't ever think he was arrogant. He was more like the fish out of water character, from what I recall. Oh, hey, I'm on Earth. I need this human girl to show me around and show me the ropes and show me what to do or whatever. And then he had some kind of, I don't know if it was like Thor's hammer or what, but he had some kind of otter pop that glue with Kirby Crackle or whatever, that was like blue, that he carried around or whatever. So I don't know if that was like, I'm trying to remember. I don't remember if that was like the source of his powers or whatever. And he does encounter Supreme in Supreme Madness, and they have a skirmish or an encounter. But like most of those were all characters. They had their own creators, their own books. You couldn't do anything of any lasting change to any of those characters. So most of those battles, I think just by default, had to end in a draw. He shows up, he's talking to his lady friend. She's still trying to show him how to eat.
Smithsonian in D.C.
And then they get into a fight.
Union plays possum and figures the easiest thing to do is just stop fighting.
Oh, right. It's like, I'll pretend Supreme kicked my ass. And Supreme's like, I kicked your ass. Ha ha. And flies off. And
if you need a stark contrast between those two characters, that's it right there. Because obviously Supreme would never fucking do that shit.
Yeah.
Supreme number 15 has Petey on art. Al Simmons got nauseous from the rot gut hooch his homeless friends swill. While he's away, Supreme takes over Spawn Alley. Al used to read about Supreme when he was a kid. It was his boyhood hero.
That's the thing I wanted to ask you about. Was, since it's Spawnometer, did you ever want to talk about specifically Supreme and Spawn meeting for the first time, like in that kooky crossover or whatever?
Unlike with the other characters, we never actually get to see them go toe-to-toe. And of course, Spawn is theoretically one of the most powerful characters in the Image Universe, but that's not where they went with the story. And I actually think that it was one of the highlights of Supreme Madness was just them having an angst off who can pee themselves harder. And it was almost like a subtextual kind of thing. It's like they're almost like fucking with the readers by going that route with that story.
Yeah, it was funny because they shared each other's backstories with each other. I thought that was kind of funny.
In the end, Spawn notes, the adulation of the crowds, oh brother. He's always been a suspicious character right from the get-go. Supreme left in a huff, arguing jealousy and threatening to show what real power is on their next meeting.
So weird, you know, like, they threw that line in there too.
That throws a little bit
successful
of the,
before I, this, I, you know? That was an odd little thing for him to throw in there, but I think they're trying to show how deluded Supreme actually is.
Yeah, yeah. I guess if you look at it from that point, that could have been him again. His ego lying to himself as it tends to do, I guess.
Well, and but then that was one of the things that was important about the crossover with Spawn too, or that crossover, but the experience post Spawn, is when he's relaying his story to Al Simmons. Al was a fan of Supreme. He grew up reading his comic books and that was like his hero. And even Al's like, no, they didn't throw a party for you when you left. They were always suspicious of you. And even Al, who doesn't strike me as being a particularly like a history buff or anything, but even Al knows that this guy's full of shit. So how deluded is this dude? How much is he a legend in his own mind before anything he actually accomplishes? Supreme number 16 has Norm Ratman on art. Skywatch deploys a Stormwatch team to search for Crazy Pants after a tip from Union. Supreme detects their cloaked vessel and attacks. He causes so much damage the city demands Stormwatch evacuate from the area. Supreme is pushed off the ship, landing on a Central Park carousel. Meanwhile, Simple Simon assesses Grizzlock's secret base under Fort Knox.
Stormwatch ultimately became the authority. Stormwatch was the Omage Studios Wildstorm, the JLA Watchtower-ish United Nations super team or something, if I can remember all the names of the characters. I think they decidedly wanted to have more of a international flavor, because I remember the big bruiser, his name was Fuji, and he had the red sun on his face, the Psylocke-looking chick. It's like Psylocke with like inverted colors, where she's got like white skin and blonde hair.
Like,
and
Diva, right?
I guess so. All that stuff is super eluding me. And then, was it Battle something?
Battalion?
Yeah. Italian, the leader, right? Yep. The head honcho or whatever. And then didn't they have some kind of dude that was, I guess, Martian Manhunter on the JLA cartoon, like DBZ, like scouter thing, where he was the watcher or the storm watcher or some shit?
He looked like the dude from Cloud City, the action figure from Empire, Lobot. Yeah. Fuck, I can't remember his name right now. In the satellite, telling guys what to do.
Yeah, he was the guy pointing out all the storms, basically, right?
Like, Skywatch was the name of the satellite, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I read some of that. I read enough of it to remember to tell people that issue 25 actually lined up with all the other issues. Like, I specifically remember that. I think I have stronger memories of Wizard hyped the shit out of the Authority, and then I went back and read that Aliens thing where like the aliens killed the shit out of all the members of Stormwatch, I think.
Yeah, that was cool.
And then because of that, I guess the fallout of that was like Apollo and Midnighter were like some of the only guys left, and then it rolled into the whole Jenny Sparks Authority stuff. That's essentially what I remember from Stormwatch.
Supreme number 17 has Rob Liefeld on layouts with art by Cedric Nocon and Norm Ratman. Pitt is in Central Park and jumped to the conclusion that Supreme had been sent by Zoivod to attack him.
Pitt was Dale Keown created character. Took forever to get issues. He was an alien. I'm trying to remember like what his relationship was with the kid's name was Timmy, wasn't it?
Yep.
I have the Build-A-Figure, that huge ass freaking Pit figure. Like, everybody goes crazy over that, and it comes with like the little Timmy or whatever, the little kid and everything. I feel like I bought maybe 3 or 4 issues, but they took forever to come out. Like, how many issues of Pit were there?
If I recall correctly, somewhere in the neighborhood of 19.
19? I know I didn't read it for that long. I'm sure I had at least like the first maybe 4 or 5 issues or something like that. The thing that I remember was weird was for a while they kept trying to pimp him, much like his appearance in Supreme Madness, because Pitt books weren't necessarily coming out on a timely schedule. I think they didn't want people to forget about Pitt, have the heat of whatever Pitt was generating die down. So it seemed like they advertised him in a lot of crossovers. And then what I specifically remember was originally he was slated to be in the Deadly Duo miniseries. It was the Larson written thing where it was like Batman and his idiot Robin or whatever you want to call it. And then it ended up being Maul from Wildcats, I think, if I'm remembering that right. Because I remember there were ads originally where it was like, dude, check it out. Pitt's going to be in the next Deadly Duo. And then I don't know if it was some kind of rights thing or something weird or whatever, but at some point it ended up becoming Maul, I think.
It's one of those weird things because Image canceled most of the second tier books, the Shaman's Tears, Trencher, Tribe, Tribe, all those guys. And Del Keon was always afraid that he was going to be chopped. And eventually he jumped and formed Full Bleed, specifically because he was afraid of getting chopped. He'd rather leave rather than get pushed out. And yet, if you look at Image Comics, it was clear that they loved Pitt and they wanted to take advantage of Pitt. And you never saw any of those other guys in other people's books, but Pitt was all over these books. So obviously there was some demand. They made the figure, so obviously there are people out there that have a fondness for the character.
I remember reading some of the early issues, but other than he's an alien and he has some kind of weird dreamlike tie to his little kid friend, he ran around doing the Terminator biker look. That's essentially what I remember of Pitt.
Supreme 18, the final chapter of Supreme Madness, has layouts by Marat Michaels, pencils by Cedric Nocon, and inks by Norm Ratman. Fighting for two issues. Once Pitt recognizes Supreme as a hero of the Creed, he relents in his assault. Supreme then passes out from exhaustion, wakes up hours later to his senses. He's attacked by an armored suited flying Simple Simon, and you got this fucking Simon Says guy who's like another crazy Lex Luthor wannabe type guy who's raiding all the shit going after him.
I'm like, Simon Says was probably supposed to be like a psycho toy man. Simple Simon was his name, and then he finds Grislock's lab and all that stuff.
He was able in stopping Simple Simon by Pitt, who vowed further service as needed to repay the debt owed to Supreme by the Creed. Supreme resents the help and captures Simple Simon on his own.
There's the issue where Pitt idolizes him because Supreme saved his entire planet. But then there's that funny bit of dialogue where he's like, oh, I just broke up that meteor for like sport. You know, I didn't mean to save the planet, but oh, whatever. It would have been cool, but I don't think they ever really did this. But to see what his exile after World War II through space up until quote unquote modern times in the 90s, sort of see that. Because to me, that sounds like something I would dig just given my predilection for outer space stuff and Superman stuff and that kind of thing. It was always just his backstory. And I remember being really interested in the backstory, whereas I think it was like just nonstop battles. It's like he fought Thor and then they did the Supreme Madness thing, which now I realize you ripped off Thor Blood and Thunder. What? They went into this whole thing where he was fighting like every Image character. I have that pestering thing in the back of my head. Supreme didn't have his powers. He just had Thor's fucking hammer. And is that a true match between him and Pitt? Is that a true match between him and Fuji? How the fuck does he punch Fuji and he goes flying when the hammer is what's powering him? Like, I don't get it, but that's apparently what was going on. And the same is true of, I think, of Union. I was trying to read up to remind myself of what happened during the course of these stories and everything. Even at one point, I started convincing myself, I'm like, oh, he must have his powers back by now. And I'm like, oh, I know what happened, even though they didn't say it. When Zachariah Grislock makes him go mad, he must have restored his powers, but the cost of that was he went mad. But then
that's exactly right, though. That is what happens. Or it seems they're not clear on it.
If you read like some of the dialogue in some of the later stories where he fights with Thor and Thor wants his hammer back, if you read the dialogue, he'll actually say, if I give up this hammer, I won't have any power.
Jesus. Okay. Like, I read through Supreme Madness and I stopped there.
That's what's weird is I thought like what you thought, because I was like, oh, he must have his powers back by now, because look at the way all these people are doing him, the way he's punching them and everything.
So you being an action figure guy, how did you like the bit that Dan Fraga did in 14 with all the toys?
Oh, yeah, that was cool, because I don't even think I knew that, you know, I wouldn't have known about like Goku at that time, but you could see like a little Goku and you could see like, you know, he was giving nods to like all the Image guys and stuff like that. So that was a pretty cool bit, I think. I like that.
They even worked Dr. Zaius in there. They had a Xenomorph, a mask figure.
Optimus
Prime. Neil Adams was the greatest artist of the 70s for most people's reckoning. And obviously he had his school going into the 80s where you had all these guys who were trained under him and had similar styles to him. But I think that there was so much Neil Adams content that was put out, and a lot of it story-wise had the same problems that Image had, where it wasn't really up to snuff in terms of writing, that it became a cliche to have that Neil Adams look. And Brian Murray, I think, was very clearly of that school. So is Michael Nasser. And so when Nasser came back in the 90s, you could see that he was very much borrowing elements of Rob Liefeld's art stylings and from Frank Miller as well, the whole chiaroscuro effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with Murray, it was more like the way that Mark Silvestri went from more of a Buscema type guy to taking on more Jim Lee-isms. He was already the artist he was going to be, but he hyped himself up to feel more imagey. And I feel like Brian Murray did a similar thing with Supreme, where he took a lot of that cross-hatching from Image, but he was still very clearly that Bronze Age classicist. And I think that worked really well for Supreme.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say I would get disappointed when the art style would change up in those early issues, because I think I came to expect that style, something that approximated Rob Liefeld, but also that Neil Adams-y sheen with the cross-hatching and the way the figures looked and all that kind of stuff. And then Sean McManus and
Cedric Norm Rabin, much more cartoony, more exaggerated look to it.
Or like the Spawn thing. It was, what was that guy's name? Pepe? Right?
Yeah, man, that was some weird looking shit because he'd have like stylistic qualities.
I'm like, how did Supreme get that gigantic spit curl or whatever that is? Like
every single character looked like an overinflated balloon.
Yeah, the art style is the art style, but some of those images I looked at where it was like funny because it's like they didn't even draw any detail. It was just like a figure with a spit curl, and that was supposed to be Supreme. And I was just like, okay. At that point, I kind of missed the Brian Murray stuff, I think.
So did you ever warm to any of the more cartoony guys?
It's interesting because sometimes I forgot who was working on it. I know there are things that Sean McManus has done before this and since this that I enjoy. I'd say like even Dan Fraga or Norm Rapmund or whatever. Like I can point to things where I've been like, oh, I liked his inks on such and such, or I liked his work on such and such. As far as in the context of this, it's one of those things where some of those styles are so vastly different. You could tell it was done to keep a schedule. Going from Rapmund to Pepe to Fraga and then back, it was like, oh, they just wanted to do the Supreme Madness thing and just get it out on some kind of schedule or something. So they had like all these divergent styles in the same story arc. I'm not going to damn that, but then I think I would have preferred, regardless of whether the style was cartoony or not cartoony, I almost would have rather had Pepe do the whole thing or Ratman do the whole thing. There were issues where early work of Todd Knock, I think before or around the same time he was doing the New Men. Oh, if you're going to do that, just do that. But it seemed like there was always a new, different guy doing it. Even though a lot of the explanation for what was going down in those last 35 issues of Supreme was super convoluted, that last 5 or 6 issue story arc from Valentino, I think he did at least the layouts or something like that. I'm not saying the art was fantastic, but it was at least consistent. There were 6 issues worth and you went, oh, okay, this is a story arc. It looks the same or whatever.
I decided I did not give enough a shit about Extreme Prejudice to read it as a story arc. But what I have been doing is I'm working on Bloodstrike, and I'm working on Supreme, and I'm working on Youngblood, and so they're constantly tying into that event.
Have you read Michel Fife's Bloodstrike yet?
I read 2 of the 3 issues because he actually gave me advanced previews
because
he was soliciting letters for the letters column.
I've been meaning to do that, and I just haven't. And I feel like I saw him do like a recreation of that. You know that issue of Bloodstrike? Strike where he comes in and he just like guts like the entire team or whatever.
Yeah, well, basically what it is, as you're talking about, they had all the Images of Tomorrow and several of them were never completed. Brigade's a good example of that, where they never actually made it to 25. Same goes for Bloodstrike. Fife is such a Giffen fan, and that run of issues that were written by Giffen were so much more interesting than anything else that was around it, that he went in there and he filled in those gaps. So he did a 0 issue to explain some of the stuff that Giffen alluded to but never got fully resolved with regard to Deadlock. And then he did an issue 23 and 24, and 23 was really about finishing out the story arcs with Tag and how she had basically a zombie venereal disease and shit. Then there's a final issue that's about Bloodstrike Assassin, and because Fife provided us those preview issues of the first two, and me and Mac got together and basically formulated a letter in response, and of course, it being me, of course, it was a more critical seeming letter, but with compliments, Mr. Fixit really loved those Giffen issues of Bloodstrike, and so he's going to finally get to resolve the story arcs by reading the Fife stuff. One of the things I made a point of doing is since I'd never read a single issue of Bloodstrike before he got in contact with us. So I decided, okay, I'm going to read these issues in absence of anything else, without any knowledge of anything else, and respond to it as somebody who's completely ignorant of the material. And so I'm looking forward to going back in through the podcast, rereading those issues, and seeing how they fit within the Bloodstrike story. Just from what I can remember from reading them the first time, I know that there's a lot of stuff that he gets involved with where he's going to get deep in the weeds. And so I'm looking forward to seeing how that stuff syncs up and how he basically finishes out those story arcs. So yeah, definitely worth checking out. Spawnomaniacs include the 108 Sage, Adriano, All the Pouches and Image Comics Podcast, Amanja of the blog Amanja Reads Too Much, Dr. Ange, Bubba Bam, Between the Pages, Cash Flag, Christopher Bush, Derek William Crabb, DeBache, Delvin, Dr. G Nerdologist, Ed Moore, El Romero Romero, Eli, Eric Borden, Estupor Profundo, Gene Hendricks of the Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, Giant Foam Dickhat, Gutslash, I know, right?
Yeah, that's a good
good one.
Yeah. Guts Last Sword, Harmless Entertainment, History of Comics on Film, Illegal Machine, Into the Weird, I Was Joe Crawford, Jason Snicked Venable, Jeffrey Brown, Keith G. Baker, King Dinosaur, Night of the Living Podcast, King Size Comics Giant Size Fun Podcast, who included a Spawn animated GIF, Michelle Fite himself, Michael Wagner, Mike at Send Aliens to Me, Mike Peacock, Monkey 76, who liked the episode 11 Supreme, which is great because we're acknowledging him in the next Supreme episode. My Kitty Blogs liked the Pit 3 In the Blood episode on our WordPress page. Odell Abner Dracula, Professor Frenzy, Rad Adventures Podcasting Network, Randy Caldwell, Relatively Geeky, Richard G, Ryan Daly Wants to Touch His Face, Schlocktopus Inc. I know, another good one. Secret Sheaf, Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Siskoid, Tim Price Podcrasher, and Vera Quang. All the Pouches wrote, I'm almost to Spawn issue number 18 and then the gap before infamously late 19 and 20. Do you know any details behind why those were so late? I haven't listened to your eps on them yet because I wait until after recording my own thoughts. And I believe that at this point he has covered some of those Spawn issues, but unfortunately All the Pouches has recently had some production delays. It's great that they were covering the Image beat while we were on our extended hiatus, so maybe we can do them a solid by covering Image in their hiatus. Kyle Benning wrote, thanks for the background info behind the delay. It happens. This is the delay in our show, not in Spawn or All the Pouches. I kind of just assumed that Frank was strapped to a chair watching Dim Debate clips over and over again a la Robot Chicken, only getting a brief reprieve long enough to fire off angry tweets about his watching. And I pointed out that watching the Democratic primary debates finally gave me an understanding of how sports work and how you had to watch them live while they happened and you wanted to watch, you know, who was winning and who was losing all this shit. And of course, at the end of it, my team totally fucking lost and I'm super pissed off about it. I now hate all the other teams and I'm just so fucking angry that my team didn't win.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's unsettling, but okay.
Mike Peacock wrote that Youngblood yearbook, aka we're totally not ripping off the Savage Land for this story at all. Illegal Machine wrote, hey, it's a Savage Land, not the Savage Land. Odell Abner Dracula wrote, I believe the Youngblood character that ended up sold to Marvel as an MLF member is Tempo. And then finally, Randy Caldwell wrote, I think Image connects to DC through the Bleed, and I guess with Marvel's sloppy time travel methods through the Quantumverse.
Oh, that wasn't that bad. You didn't need me for that.
Sometimes you have more that you want to contribute, but even just being here, I'm talking to you rather than talking at a microphone.
Okay. So you just need me for moral support.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, we've done a better part of episodes on tangents related to comments that people have left, but this time it just wasn't as fruitful.
No.
Good afternoon, Mr. President. Sorry I've been away so long. I won't let you down again.
It's finally here, coming to the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
General, would you care to step outside?
It's Superman 2 Movie Minute.
Chris Franklin and Rob Kelly are back to discuss 1980's Superman 2, 5 minutes at a time.
Superman faces his toughest challenge when he squares off against Lex Luthor and three villains from the planet Krypton.
Superman 2 Movie Minute, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Man, this is going to be good.
Once upon a time, five friends who met on the Bot Talk Transformers forum set out to develop a podcast dedicated to their various interests. Transformers, science fiction, fantasy, and comic books. Part fanboys and part assholes, they came to be known as the Fanholes. Their unbridled enthusiasm for podcasting did not end there, and soon enough, their proper podcast spun off into the Fanholes network of podcasts. Besides our podcast proper, the Fanholes soon had a continuum of genre-specific, focused shows such as Mobile Suit Mondays, Transformers Tuesdays, Toku Thursdays, and Sentai Saturdays. New weekly content can be found on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and fanholespodcast.blogspot.com. Fanholes Podcast, the pop culture podcast, made for the fans, by the fans.
Hey everyone, I'm Michael Bailey.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
You might remember us from such show as From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
Whatever happened to that show?
Well, it went away and now it's back.
We're back?
That's right, after taking a year off and having a preview episode on April 1st, all new episodes of From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, will be available for download or subscription on your favorite podcatcher starting on May 30th, 2018.
We have a lot to talk about right away, like the aftermath of the death of Clark Kent,
the end of Season 2 of Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman,
all of the Superman-related annuals under the Year 1 banner,
Superman v. Aliens, Dawn of a Really Good Crossover,
and so much more as we continue through the triangle-numbered books and the related books for the second half of 1995 as we gear up for that line-wide crossover,
Underworld Unleashed,
starring the newly revived Lex Luthor, and the Superman crossover, The Trial of Superman.
And right around the corner, there's a wedding and a major change for both the costume and powers of the Man of Steel.
There's a wedding? Who's getting married? Plus, the side titles, miniseries, and one-shots that we've been really excited to tackle.
From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, covering the post-crisis on Infinite Earths era of Superman. New episodes drop on Thursdays, mostly. Unless they don't, but there's usually a very good excuse. Show notes, images from the comics covered, and back episodes can be found at www.fortressofbaileytude.com.
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials believed to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!